This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this particular podcast is completely different from what we have done in the past in that this is a very time-sensitive type of a podcast to a degree. Others have some parts of this podcast actually certainly belong in the archives because it has a lot of good information about what's been going on historically through time as far as magic in the Big Apple or in New York City. To begin with, that the Salute to Magic, which is an annual event, in fact, this will be the 109th showing, or Salute to Magic, is coming up this Saturday, April the 14th. Now, this is being released right now here on Thursday, April the 12th, so you've only got a couple of days kind of in advance of this. And let me say that this is completely atypical, because the purpose of this podcast is not to promote one event over another or anything of that means. There is, however, a lot of information in this podcast having to do with the history of magic in New York. And the bulk of the podcast certainly talks about that and gives a lot of insight and background. It, I think, is just very interesting. And we've got some interesting people to talk to about that. But the point is that also that this Salute to Magic has been around for over 100 years, and they have honored a lot of great magicians in the past, like Harry Blackstone Jr. and Houdini and Cardini, Slidini, probably a lot of other people whose last names are Eni, including Miney and Moe. I don't know. Anyhow, they've had this going on for a long number of years. And along with this, if you happen to be in New York City or around there or planning to visit this weekend, you might be interested then in trying to secure a couple of tickets to this, because they are offering a couple of free adult priced tickets for listeners to enter a contest. And we'll talk about that on the back side of this podcast after we're finished. But first, I want to introduce the people who are going to be part of this podcast, because they are the ones who were the ones who know the most about the history of this. Unfortunately, we were unable to get a couple of people that I really wanted to have on this tonight. And I say tonight because this was recorded on this Sunday evening. And I was hoping to get George Schindler, who is the dean of the Society of American Magicians. And he has a lot of information about the history of magic, certainly in New York City, as well as just history in general, having known and worked with some of the greats over the years as well. Anyhow, we do have some very interesting people to talk with. And again, we first talk a little bit about the 109th Salute to Magic, which again is going to be this April the 14th, this Saturday at 7:30. It's going to be at the Fashion Institute of Technology, their Haft Theater, which is at 227 West 27th Street between 7th and 8th Avenue. And again, for those of you who don't care necessarily about this or don't plan to attend, you can kind of skip through this but I think that it's interesting to know kind of who's coordinating this and who's going to be performing in it. And as well afterwards, of course, we do talk a lot about Al Flasso and Max Molini and others who have been part of New York's rich history of magic. So I am going to step out of the way over here and introduce the guests that we have here this week. And as I said, don't forget to listen to the back part of this podcast if you're interested in hearing how that you can win a couple of tickets. And also, I want to, in the back part of this, announce who the three winners are of the books that were being given away of Nate Sanforth's book, This Is Real Magic. I know that several of you have entered the contest and would like to know who actually won. So I'll announce that in the backside of this as well. But for now, please welcome my guests, Mr. David Kay, Richard Cohen, and Herb Scheer, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and we have a little bit different kind of a format here this evening, or which we're actually recording this in the evening, because I have not one, but three gentlemen to speak here about the subject. And it's a vast subject, and we're going to try to kind of hit on a lot of different things having to do mainly with magic in New York City, not just magic in the state, but I mean, you know, being in the largest cities in the entire world, I mean, and magic that's been ongoing for such a long time. It's kind of hard to keep up with all that. But we're going to see what we can do and also kind of bring it home, because I want to talk a little bit about the annual Salute to Magic, which is one of the oldest magic shows that has been playing in New York, that has honored a lot of different magicians. And the Salute to Magic is actually something that is from Assembly No. 1 from the Society of American Magicians. And I'm really getting ahead of myself. I need to introduce my guests here, first of all. Three different guys. First of all, please welcome Herb Scheer. Hi there, Herb.
Hi, Scott. Pleased to be here.
I'm glad that you're here. And then also to talk a little bit, who's got someone who is an authority on Coney Island, we've got then Mr. Rich Cohen. Hey, Rich. How are you?
Hi. How are you, Scott? I'm fine. Thank you.
Fantastic. And then coming in over here on third base, we've got Danny Kaye, Silly Billy. And I think you guys know his voice. We used to talk a lot. Hi there, David.
Hi, Scott. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk with you as well. Hey, now listen, the reason I kind of wanted to talk again was just kind of about magic in New York, because it's a vast subject. But I wanted to try to move this forward in the timeline to get this podcast out here quickly, because there's an event coming up very soon that's going to be, what, Saturday, April the 14th? Is that correct, David?
That is correct.
And that's the Salute to Magic. And Herb, can you tell me a little bit about the Salute to Magic and kind of, I guess, a little bit about, first of all, I guess, what's been leading up to this, because some of the history?
Well, it's the 109th Salute to Magic, and it's always been the annual show of the Parent Assembly of the SAM. And I think it was initiated originally as a fundraiser for the Assembly, which it actually has continued to be. And over the years, when you look back at the list of people that have performed, I mean, it's pretty much every great name of magic, yeah, from Houdini to Vernon to Dunninger. And this year, David is the producer of the Salute. He's put together a great bill, which includes Harrison Greenbaum, Elliot Zimmet, Kristen Lambert, Mike Bent, John Bundy and Morgan, and Keith Nelson, who's kind of our variety artist, but who does this incredible plate spinning act like you don't see these days. So it's going to be a great show at the Haft Theater at the Fashion Institute of Technology on the 14th.
Yeah, usually if you talk about the variety entertainer, that's the one who seems to be the, in a magic convention, the one who's most remembered, you know. So,
they do stand up, but I think that the magicians that we've got in the bill are great too. It's just,
yes. We've got two really
hysterical comedy magicians and a great illusionist, and Elliot Zimmet doing a really contemporary act with his birds and other, you know, type of magic. It's important to mention also that David Kaye is going to be the co-host, the MC, the co-MC with Kristen Lambert. So I'm really intrigued to see how that's all going to play out, because David says that those two are old friends and they always crack each other up.
Oh, because typically you just have one host, I guess, one MC.
That's what we've had in the past. David, do you want to talk a little bit about your idea for that?
Yes. Well, originally I'm producing the show. So I was, but I really wanted to be in the show, because I work for free. And since I'm producing the show, that's good for my budget.
But the price is right.
The price is right. Sign me up.
Come on down.
But I was worried that I have to be putting out fires during the show. And so having it just occurred to me that having a co-MC, let's say, for example, if I have to be backstage fixing something during one of the introductions, then Kristen can go out on her own and she'll do the introduction. Mm-hmm. So it takes a little bit of the pressure off me, but it still gets me to be on stage. And I think it's going to be fun. I have never seen, to my memory, I have not seen a magic show with a pair of MCs, and so we'll see what it's like. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that does sound like a lot of fun.
One thing that we're excited about is that Kristen Lambert has never performed on stage in New York City, so this is going to be her debut here in New York, which we're very excited about. And I think all of these acts, or most of them anyway, had national recognition on television, America's Got Talent, and Teller Fools and all that. And we're pulling them together all in one show. at an extremely reasonable ticket price, I might add. And so it's kind of a really rare opportunity to, you know, get a group of magicians together like this for one night.
With Kristen Lambert, by the way, I thought she had worked in New York, because I know she was with the Supernaturalist, and I guess they'd played outside of the city, but she hasn't actually been in a performance there.
That is correct. Good job. She was on there. The Supernaturalist played Long Island.
Okay, that's about as close to the city, I guess, as, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, but not New York City.
So she doesn't reside there. She is from California, I think, isn't she?
That's right. She lives in L.A.
Okay.
Yep.
So she's your traveling act, I guess, who's come. The rest of them are kind of local New Yorkers?
Yes, yes. She's actually
going to be... Mike's from Boston.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point. That's right. Thanks, Rich, yeah.
Mike is driving down from Boston. The other acts are, you know, local. John Bundy lives in New Jersey, but he's driving in, and the rest of the cast, I think, lives, well, just, you know, within the city limits. But Kristen was a late addition because, well, because I didn't want to spend money to fly people in because I don't have the budget for that.
Yeah.
But she's going to be in town for a completely different reason than the other reason is paying for her trip. And so since she, and I just found that out about 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. So it's a new addition.
It's a new addition, and and she wants to be on stage, and I want her to be on stage. She's also going to do a set besides emceeing. She's going to do her own set.
She's going to do her Linking Rings, or what's she going to do?
It's a mentalism piece. I don't.
Ah, interesting.
Well, yeah, I don't. It's a mentalism piece. It's a very interesting mentalism piece. So
Also, I think an important part of the Salute to Magic, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the person who is being honored. And this year, it's you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Every year we honor the Magician of the Year, and this year it's Bob Little. And
excellent choice.
Fantastic choice, because certainly in the Northeast, but really, you know, if you've ever been to a magic convention since 1960, you've seen Bob Little at that magic convention. He does 30 conventions a year.
Wow.
And it's funny because he and I were talking, so that, you know, I wrote a bio of him for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks of he's always thought of his magic shop as a magic shop on wheels. And it's a fascinating way of looking at it. You know, he doesn't have a brick and mortar. He never had a brick and mortar. And this is even before there was internet.
Right.
And yeah, so his magic shop would travel from magic convention to magic convention. But, you know, not only is he a presence at every magic convention you've ever been to, you know, he's done a lot to help young magicians with their acts. He does his own act. He was a very talented magician when he was younger. He did close up. He did a lot of card work. And he's also famous for doing a very funny spoof act at conventions, where he was dressed as a dove in a giant bird mm-hmm. costume. And he would produce little magicians.
Okay.
That was the great Davino.
Davino, right.
Davino was a dove who produced magicians.
I've seen the black and white publicity picture of that. That was very funny looking. I'd like to have seen that act.
Yeah, he sent me a DVD.
Oh.
So that I'm very happy to have this, because obviously he's not doing the act anymore.
Right.
And it's very funny. And it's all the standard, you know, the class. We know the dove moves. We know when a magician is going to steal a dove, and we can see it happening because we're magicians.
Mm-hmm.
So he spoofs, you know, all that sort of formulaic.
Yes.
Moves that we've all seen.
Now, in the past, you've had other people that you have had. I believe, Herb, you were saying that you have honored people, you know, over the past 100-plus years. Name some of the people who have been honored. I know, like Eric DeCamps, I think a couple of years ago was one I remember.
In recent memory, it was Rene Clement, Ted Lee, the mortician magician. Other members of the parent assembly are typically honored. But over the years, some real famous people like Amadeo, Cesario from the Grand David Troupe up mm-hmm. in the Massachusetts.
I can tell you some of the famous names from the past.
Cardini, Leo Horowitz.
Al Flosso, Slidini, John Scarney, Giardi, David Copperfield, Harry Blackstone, Harry Lorraine.
Howard Blackstone Jr.
Yes, sorry, that's correct. Jeff McBride, as we're getting closer, modern day.
Jeff on that.
John Calvert, 2001.
That's right. John and Tammy were there.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, a lot of big names over the years. Yeah. Now, also.
And it goes back quite a ways. They originally called it a Magic Vaudeville when they had it in the early days back at the Carnegie Lyceum. And, of course, some of the names they had back then were just, you know, legendary people like Houdini, his brother Hardeen, Cardini, Theo Bamberg, a lot of those people in those early shows that morphed into the Salute to Magic.
Back then, when you stop to think about it, of course, we didn't have the television and certainly the internet or anything for people to see. And so they were very well known on the circuit, used to travel around. And so they were well known magicians. And so, yeah, I'm sure that they were just huge names at the time, even though people today are big names, but they will never rival what they used to be just because that there are not many people who had seen them, I guess. You know, they had to travel. Now, what about the size of the audience? What size of a group or the hall, the venue is this?
Well, we've had the show over the years in – it moves. It's for many years, and Rich will confirm this, it was always in
Hunter
the same –
Hunter College.
Way. Hunter College. This is when it, when I was growing up. Every year it was at Hunter College. It's moved from a venue as small as about 200 seats, and we had it in a venue as large as 900 seats. Mm-hmm. This year, it's in a venue of 700 seats.
And so it's including dinner and everything, too, or just a show?
No, just a show.
And do they have close-up or strolling beforehand?
Nope, just a stage show, an old-fashioned vaudeville-type variety show. In the old days, they used to have a live orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Because also back in the old days, bands had sheet music.
Yeah.
I mean, the performers had their own charts that they'd have the musicians play.
Right.
And in an earlier age, with live entertainment throughout the country and throughout the world, that was standard to have live accompaniment. Today, everybody works to recorded music.
Sure.
And typically even stuff that's activated by remote control, and they have all their cues working on that. So people don't really work with musicians and stage hands
right.
the way they used to. But these shows are old style of variety show. It's all platform, all theater magic.
You did have the larger venues. Wasn't the Strut Club in New York and some other places, I think, like that, which were nice nightclubs and venues where magicians would travel?
Yeah, well, not the Strut Club so much, but the Playboy Circuit.
That's true.
Playboy Club here, Johnny Thompson, Bobby Baxter, all those guys.
Harry Blackstone
Jr. Yep. came back into magic through that. He'd been with the Smothers Brothers before that with their in the TV and radio field.
Mm-hmm.
So those were nightclubs that catered to the public but had magic as well. There were other places that had floor shows here. So some of the guys like Bobby Baxter worked that stuff. The floor shows, Keith Clark, famous cigarette act.
Mm-hmm.
People don't do cigarette act anymore.
No, that's true.
But they did back then.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, and going back also, now I mentioned early on that Rich was has a vast knowledge about Coney Island. And my question is, was there a nightclub or something kind of like that in the evening, kind of entertainment at Coney Island?
Well, not so much. There was a big theater called Henderson's Music Hall at Coney Island in the heyday. And you get dinner and a show. But a lot of the Coney Island magic was more of a sideshow type thing, although there were magic theaters in the amusement parks that you could go see, but not really so much the same thing as a nightclub with a floor show like a Copacabana or a, a Playboy Club in more recent memory.
But did they have an outdoor venue where they had live bands and, you know, big swing bands and big bands there at Coney Island?
At Coney Island?
Yeah.
There were big dance halls, Stouch's and the Ocean Pavilion, but magicians played a different role at Coney Island than in a vaudeville theater or a nightclub.
You know, Richard and I and a couple of other guys, George Schindler and Mark Mitten, just did an event about magic in Coney Island at the Brooklyn Public Library. And I was really rather amazed at the fact that we discovered, which is that Gene Hugard had a theater there at Luna Park, right, Rich?
That's right. That's right.
And he wrote
A Night in Peking.
He wrote that on one Sunday, I think it was July 4th, 1920, or one day, he performed in multiple shows to almost 12,000 people on one day.
One day. And,
yeah. But yeah, you can move that kind of numbers through an amusement park, different than a nightclub.
That's a good point.
When you think about, like, today, I mean, could you say a magician that has performed to that many people in one day? I mean, it's really incredible. I mean, I think to think about the role that magic played and just the role that Coney Island played in the life of New York here as a kind of escapist location for people to get away from their, you know, day to day.
Right.
Well, that's a good point, because it's now people, of course, have been using television to reach the masses. And back then,
exactly,
before television, the masses came to see the act. Now the act uses television really as the vehicle to get to the audience. So it's completely different.
It's very different to work for that many live
mm-hmm.
customers
mm-hmm.
than it is to work for people on a video tap.
Right, right. And so when they came in, now, as far as the, you mentioned Al Flasso being someone who had been honored at one of the salutes to the magic in the past.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Sure.
He
was a great figure here in New York. He was very important because he worked at Coney Island.
Yeah, tell me something about
him. And he later worked on TV. Well, Al Flasso, a lot of people also don't realize that he had a wonderful magic shop later on that he acquired from a fellow, Frank Ducrot,
mm-hmm.
as kind of Martinka's magic shop, which was the legendary back room where the Society of American Magicians was founded back in, I think, 1902.
Hmm.
May was the foundation date. But Flasso was somebody who was immersed in magic all his life. His wife, Lillian, was from one of the premier magic families here in New York. Flasso's father-in-law was a fellow by the name of Professor Louis Krieger, master of the cups and balls. And at Coney Island, Flasso and the rest of the Kriegers, they worked and did different sideshows and things. Flasso's probably the best known, but his brother-in-law, Willie Krieger, of course, his wife, Lillian, worked as a mitt reader, as they would call him, a sort of a mind reader and fortune teller. Willie worked in one of the sideshows, Norma Krieger, his wife. So that was a great New York magic dynasty that Flasso, sometimes known as the King of Coins, and also known as the Coney Island Fakir,
mm-hmm.
not, some people call it Faker, but it's spelled F-A-K-I-R,
right.
which was a name he was given by the famous comedian Milton Berle, who's the one who gave Flasso that special nickname of the Coney Island Fakir. So Flasso's style was very much rooted in that sideshow thing. And although he worked at Huber's, famous kind of dime museum out in Coney Island, he kind of parlayed that style into the work that he later did on the Ed Sullivan Show. I think some folks can still recall that.
Yeah.
And there's still clips of Flasso doing his act from that show and another New York show called Wonderama, that in the early days also hosted a lot of magicians. Amazing Randy was one of the guys on that. I remember it from when I was a kid.
Yeah, it seems like the clip that I had seen Al Flasso do, of course, what I guess I think he was most famous for was his Miser's Dream kind
yes.
of thing.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, last week at this event that Herb put together at the Brooklyn Library, Mark Mitten did a fantastic recreation, I thought, of Flasso's Miser's Dream. It was a lot of Mark, who was a very talented magician.
Yes.
But it also was a wonderful tribute to Al Flasso, who was so much of an influence on those of us who grew up in the New York magic area.
Did he kind of dress up, look a little bit like Al with the top hat and the
he
big glasses?
He put on a tie.
Tie?
he had a morning coat, and
yeah.
he put on the tie.
Uh-huh.
He put on the accent.
Yeah, he did a great job.
He played it really well. He really did.
It was very, very funny, and it was really fun.
Now, you said that Milton Berle had given him that name. Was he traveling
yes.
with Milton Berle, or did Milton Berle just happen to be
passing through? No, he was working at one of the nightclubs,
yeah.
and Berle was here in New York, and Milton Berle was a magic nut. Berle was always into doing card tricks.
I did not know that.
Berle was a customer many years, mentioned in the catalogs of Max Holden's magic shop.
Mm-hmm.
If we had been fortunate enough to have George Schindler on this tonight, George could have told us about when he worked at Holden's. Hmm. But Milton Berle was just in the heyday of early TV and vaudeville, just one of the top banana comedians and directors who was really into magic. There were a lot of other guys in show business who weren't necessarily performing magicians, but who loved magic, mm-hmm. in New York City particularly, because this was the heart of the theater business, and the vaudeville circuits all emanated from here. And of course, you had the Palace Theater, which was the apex of anybody's career at that time. You play the Palace, you were made, and yeah. magicians, that was an important date to play.
And that was which palace? The what?
The Palace, the famous Palace Theater here in New York City.
Oh, it's called the Palace.
It's called
okay.
the Palace.
Okay.
It's yeah. the Palace. It's the original. And today, play the Palace.
And today it's still there as a Broadway house.
That's right. It's a Broadway theater now. I mean, I could get more detail. It was built by Martin Beck, who was Houdini's early manager.
Right. Yeah, back on the circuit, on the vaudeville circuit from way back that day.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Now, I know that Houdini lived in New York also for a while, and I thought it was interesting, as you say, about how the there's an overlap, I guess, of some vaudeville and theatrical people, because that he was the one who gave Buster Keaton his name.
That is correct. That's right.
You want to tell that story?
Well, Buster Keaton was part of the Three Keatons. His parents had an acrobatic act, and I think while they did acrobatics, the mother played saxophone, and the father would throw little Buster, who was like 4 or 5 years old, around like a medicine ball. I don't know if a lot of people know what a medicine ball is these days, but he'd throw the kid around, and sometimes he would slam into the drapes and the legs of the fabric drapes in the theater, and he'd smash stuff backstage, accidentally.
Yeah.
And that's why Houdini gave him the moniker Buster. Houdini was big on that, on giving people nicknames and giving people dogs. Houdini gave Lafayette his famous dog Beauty.
Beauty, I've forgotten that
so
story.
Much.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a great story, because on Lafayette's checks, it had a little picture of Beauty, it had a picture of money bags, and underneath it said, "My only two friends."
Now, as I recall, I think Lafayette was even buried with his dog.
He was. And yeah. Scott in Great Britain, yeah. Yep. But Houdini was friends with all these people. He was a very a tough guy, but very fraternal, too. He gave his brother, Hardeen, his brother Theo.
Mm-hmm.
Houdini made up that name for his brother, who was originally his partner, one of his partners in the act called the Houdini Brothers.
Before he met Bess, right.
Yes.
Because they did Metamorphosis together.
That's right. Hardeen actually was dating Bess first.
Ah, that's interesting.
Get out of here.
That's true. And they were all from Brooklyn. At that point, the Houdini brothers lived in Brooklyn. Bess was from Greenpoint. A lot of people went down to Coney Island to work because there was work there. That's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why magicians worked there in so many different capacities. You could, you know, kind of work and make a living and get by.
What kind of play? When you say work, I mean that they were just had little sideshows or something?
Well, it depends who. Hmm. Are we talking about Houdini and Hardeen? Are we talking about Gene Hugard? Talking about Flosso?
Well, you were saying
about more recently.
You were saying some of the magicians would come in just to make some extra money, or to, you know, they come to Coney Island, and I just wondered. I guess they weren't working, well, you know, with a Ferris wheel or something.
No. But I mean, take Di Vernon, for example.
Oh, yeah, Silhouettes.
He cut Silhouettes at Luna Park.
Yeah.
And he hung out with all the magicians there.
Hmm.
He met his wife Jean at the sawing A Woman in Half unit. Horace Golden, a lot of people don't realize, had several units for sawing A Woman in Half that he played around the country to try to beat out P.T. Silbert. But Vernon's wife worked in that troupe. She was the legs. And he met her at Coney Island.
Huh.
Yep. Thanks. He wondered how come during the show he never saw that pretty girl that he would talk to during the intermission and after. He never saw her. Then he realized the legs.
That's funny.
That's hilarious.
I didn't know that. Well, yeah, it seems like that Horace Golden, that he tried to protect his sawing, but there was someone else, was it Carter, that would set up right, or maybe it was Golden, that would set up right across the street.
Well, it was P.T. Philbin. The original sawing A Woman in Half was invented by the famous British illusionist and magician, P.T. Philbin, real name Percy Tibbles.
Yeah.
But Golden started presenting it here and then slammed the other units with injunctions to stop them from working. But then Golden set up several units. Harry Jansen, who later became Dante, worked one of the units. Survey Leroy worked one of the units. Sawing A Woman in Half was such a big deal that at one point, Jarrow, the sleight-of-hand guy who did the Bill and Lemon.
Yep.
He would set up, get booked across the street from Sawing A Woman in Half, and on the marquee it would say, Jarrow, Sawing A Lemon in Half.
That's the story,
I'm
yeah.
I'm not making this up. This is how it was done back in the day of live entertainment, before TV, before the internet.
Yeah.
Constantly trying to come up with some way to get people to come into the theater.
I remember David Charvet telling that story. He was also, because David had confirmed
that's
for
right.
me.
David did the book on, that's right, the Lemon book.
Yeah. Yep. Because I was had read that he, Jarrow, was a strong man, and he could actually stick his thumb into any lemon, you know, and then the bill would be in there. So, you know, whichever, he would already have it in the thumb tip, and whenever that he was ready to produce it, then he could shove his thumb down the lemon. And and he said, yeah, absolutely, he was a strong man.
He was a strong man, and he worked on the Bowery in a lot of the same places that Max Mellini worked. And that was kind of busking, and that was, once again, to some degree, that was done at Coney Island, too. A little bit of busking, not so much on the boardwalk where the amusements were, but more so at the luxury hotels that were a little further east, like Manhattan Beach and Brighton Beach.
I'm glad we're talking about this, because
adjoin Coney Island.
I've really got a burning question that's bothered me for a long number of years, that I had heard that Max Mellini had belonged to the Friars Club, and the reason that he had been invited to belong is because he was not a pushy magician. In other words, of course, as you know, the story about how he would carry the ice with him, and whether he was would use it or not, but, you know, he would... he was always ready, but the point is that he wasn't foisting himself, I guess, on people to show them magic all the time, and they liked the guy, and so they had invited him to the Friars Club. Well, I had published that somewhere, and Steve Cohen called me some time ago and said, I belong to the Friars Club now, and I'm trying to do some research on Mellini, and I can't find where he was ever a member. And he said, where did you get your information? And I cannot for the life of me remember where I had heard that. So do you know, Rich, whether that's true or not?
I don't know.
Ah, okay.
I would say that Mellini was a very different type of magician, but he was kind of pushy, actually, because he would buttonhole people. He had a whole different style of promotion. He would go to the watering holes of the wealthy and buttonhole people in the bar and come close to embarrassing them, as he would do close-up magic and then knock their socks off, and then he'd sell tickets for his show in the bar, which he would promote through the hotel or the resort that he was sort of traveling to.
Okay.
So cannot corroborate that story about the Friars Club.
Okay. Well, it's just the opposite also. Kind
check
of
with Freddie Roman.
Is he someone there in the city who would be?
No, Freddie Roman, I think he's a Borschtfeld comic who used to be friends with Baxter, who is the president of the Friars Club right now.
Oh, then he should know, I would think, yeah. Well, I suspect that Steve may have already pursued that in the line of questioning, but we're just trying to corroborate that, because I went back through my sources where I thought I had read that and I quoted it, so I may be wrong. So I'll stand corrected, or else I'm still trying to find the answer on that. So, but it sounds like from what you're saying that Mellini was someone who would kind of force himself on people, so to show them magic.
Yes, but in a different way than other magicians. Different way than other magicians, and he was very successful in his way.
Mm-hmm. And did you have you talked with people who had seen Mellini perform?
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, Mark Mitten, who recently did the show last week with Herb and George and I, he was friendly with Mellini's son. What was his son's name? Began with an O. Oh, I can't remember right now. So Mark was very familiar with it.
Like Oscar or something like that?
Yeah, I want to say more almost like Omar, sort of an exotic, unusual name.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been Oscar or Ozzy. But, Ozzy Mellini.
Yes,
but George might have seen him. Mellini was gone by the late 40s, so I don't know if there's too many folks still around who actually saw him work. But the point I was making before was that in his early days, he worked on the Bowery in New York City, which was another proving ground for a lot of magicians. The Bowery way back was sort of the entertainment district in New York City. It kind of traced the way the magic shops moved uptown with the entertainment districts in New York City, from the Bowery to Union Square, 23rd Street to 34th Street, and then finally 42nd Street, which was, you know, really in the heart of what a lot of people today consider the theater district. But it really moved uptown through the generations here in New York City.
I always thought of the Bowery as being someplace that was kind of a seedy part of town, but I remember like the Bowery Boys.
It was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was. Yeah. Mm. But, you know, even back then there was a great magic shop down there, the famous Otto Maurer magic shop. Published a nice catalog. I think it was 123 The Bowery.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times magic shops were in the seedier parts of the city.
That's true.
Ken Brooks over in London. Some of the places that Jack Channon was in was kind of, you know, a little run down, Philadelphia. But that was sort of the sparkle of a lot of magic and theater.
I think that carried on then, and also, Rich, not just there, but throughout the country in different places where I have seen, used to be when there were a lot more magic shops, and I would travel around, and I would always seek them out. But they also, they were not necessarily always in the bad part of town, but they always, in order to keep the lights on, would sell adult novelties and things like that, you know, in the back room.
Many of them did, yes. Yeah, Frank Lane's up in Boston did that, yeah. 16-millimeter movies. A little rental on the side with that stuff.
Yeah. It was kind of
But some places were
time.
Exclusively magic. Flosso was pretty much exclusively magic. Lieutenant's, Holden's here in New York, exclusively magic.
What I think of is in Baltimore.
Denny, but way back it was Phil Thomas.
Yeah, but Denny has nothing but magic in his shop.
That's right. That's a real magic shop. And up in Boston, there was the Holden shop that Herman Hansen ran. And we had other shops here that, you know, was some of the oldest magic shops in the United States, if we trace it back, were here in New York City.
Yeah, and Houdini, as you said.
Hartz and Levy.
You said that Houdini, of course, worked in Holden's, and that I had heard that
No, Houdini did not work at Holden's. George Schindler worked at Holden. Yeah.
Where did Houdini work? Because from time to time, I understand he signed the receipts sometimes at magic shops.
Well, at one point, Houdini owned Martinka.
Martinka's, thank you. That's the one.
Yes, he owned Martinka after Charlie Carter, Carter the Great. And then later, Houdini kind of got it into the hands of Professor Otto Hornman, and then it wound up in the hands of Frank Ducrow, who had it just before Al Flosso. Frank Ducrow is another very important character here in New York. He published one of the first magic magazines in the English language, Mahatma, here in New York.
Oh, yeah.
He was editor and publisher. There was a lot of great magic magazines out of New York in the day. Mahatma.
Tops.
The Jinx. No, Tops was Michigan. That was Abbott's.
That was Abbott's.
Abbott's had a store in New York, but American Magician. The Sphinx was published for many years in New York at 130 West 42nd Street, right next to Lieutenant's.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Martinka's, by the way, I don't know if this is a diversion, but Martinka's, to my knowledge, was important in New York magic history for a lot of reasons, but one of which is that the Society of American Magicians was founded there, kind of in the back room of Martinka's, and they were, I think, getting together kind of casually. And there were a couple of people, I know Sarum Ellison was one who was a New York City physician, decided to form a magic club in 1902. And so it was there in Martinka's that the SAM was born.
That's right.
And that club was local here in New York until later on it expanded nationally, I believe, pretty much at the instigation of Houdini. And so then we here in New York became the parent assembly. And the SAM grew nationally and internationally. But it was all there in the back room of Martinka's that it began.
But they said that was the headquarters for magic in America.
Yeah. You know, I'd heard later years, of course, when the IBM formed, that some of the guys who had gone to talk to Houdini about forming this new club, he was pretty adamant in saying there's no room for another club. There shouldn't be. There's already the SAM. Why do you want to have another club? Should only be one organization.
I guess I could imagine Houdini saying that, knowing, you know, what I do of his personality.
Well, a lot of the other early assemblies of the Society of American Magicians were independent magic clubs that Houdini brought into the fold of the Society of American Magicians. Mm-hmm. The club out in San Francisco, the club in Chicago, the club in St. Louis, those were independent clubs prior to that time.
But because he traveled so much, I guess, and he visited with these other magicians and magic clubs, and he kind of...
Because actually, you know, it's curious, earlier on, he had been kicked out of the SAM for exposure.
These kind
of things happen periodically in the old days where the really prominent magicians who were members of clubs, this happened also with David Devant.
The Magic Circle.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because they were so prominent, they would get involved with publicity things and promotions with newspapers and publishing books and this and that. And they would reveal things that some people felt you should not reveal these secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Periodically, some of the biggest names in magic would get booted out of their different organizations.
Right, right.
But you got to sell your pitch book. You got to make some money.
That's right.
In the back of the room.
Now, again, that not just with the magicians and the different clubs and magic shops, but there are also some magic and magic clubs, but also there were some magic venues such as the Magic Townhouse and Imams.
Yes.
Or were those
Darcy
two separate
Dietrich.
Places?
Yes, those are two different places.
Okay.
The Magic Townhouse was Dorothy and Dick Dietrich.
Dorothy Dietrich and Dick Brooks.
Sorry, Dick Brooks, yeah.
And then Iman's place was called Mostly Magic on Carmine Street. That ran for a long time. That was a great magic venue. And these days we still have Monday Night Magic over at the Players Theater on McDougal Street every Monday night. And Magic at Coney and Taste of Magic. These are a few of the ongoing magic venues here in New York City.
And what's the Magic at Coney? I've not heard of that one.
At the Coney Island Museum on Surf Avenue every Sunday is a magic show. I perform there fairly regularly, but they've got some wonderful people who've been there. Bobby Torkova, Rocco, Jim Vines, who recently won a bunch of awards.
Yep.
Harrison Greenbaum, who's going to be in the show next week. They've all worked down there at different points, and that's been going on for about 6 or 7 years now.
Now, Imams was a magic bar, though, too, wasn't it?
Bar and restaurant, yeah.
Bar and restaurant, yeah. And they had close-up working the tables, or did they have a stage show also?
They had both. At one point, Jamie Ian Swiss was a bartender there, so he did some bar magic.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had all the great acts who were around in New York at that time. Actually, Bobby Torkova, he worked there. Totally different style than what he does now. That's mm-hmm. where I met Bob. Mary Yedid was there. Bobby Baxter. Margaret Steele.
And Slidini. The first time I saw Slidini. Was at Mostly Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's one thing interesting, and that is... Mostly Magic was a nightclub open 7 nights a week, and but all the other venues we're naming now are once a week venues.
Well,
that's the way it is.
Yeah,
the magic table used to be every day. Now it's just Fridays.
Yeah,
that's another good point. As I recall, it seemed like the Harry Lorraine used to have the Saturday Magic Roundtable. Is that still ongoing, or whatever became of that?
Yeah.
The group still meets. It meets at Cafe Rustico, which is a block away from Tannen's. It's on 35th Street between 5th and 6th. And that group, which actually I believe in some form or another has been ongoing since the 1940s.
That was at Rubens originally.
Right, and then before
that's
that.
That's the Rubens group.
When Tannen's closed on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock, we all went down to...
cafeteria.
Yeah. What was the name of it?
It was the Governor.
The
Governor Cafeteria.
The Governor.
Yes, yeah.
I think so, yeah.
I think it was at other places as well. But one of the things about that group that I think is so great is that if you come on any Saturday now, you can connect with, as we were talking about this history, there are still folks around who were part of magic history at some of those points. In particular, I'm thinking of Saul Stone, who
Absolutely.
Is in his mid-90s now, but who comes pretty regularly, almost every Saturday there. And Saul has incredible stories about having seen Nate Leipzig perform, about having been to the home of Di Vernon, and seeing Flosso and Hugh Gard at Coney Island. So, I mean, there's other folks there like Wesley James and Doug Edwards and many others who've been part of New York Magic history. David Roth comes by fairly frequently on a Saturday. But I think that Saul is a living treasure of New York City Magic history. And I'm saying that to encourage people to come by and see him. He still does a lot of great magic, and he entertains people there and teaches them, and as do the others as well. I mean, you know, everybody there is very willing to share and teach, and it's still a nice community there.
And Herb, what time and where do they meet?
It's at Cafe Rustico, which is, I think the address is 25 West 35th Street, but it's between 5th and 6th. And it's a block away from Tannen, so a lot of people, and also just a block and a half from Phantasma Magic. So there's kind of a little magic district, which on Saturdays...
Yes, it's very traditional in New York City, yes.
Right. A lot of people make a circuit between those different locations. So there's a nice hangout scene at Tannen's as well, also at Phantasma. So, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, the history of magic in New York has encompassed a lot of these shows that we've been talking about, but there's also the sort of, like, casual community, or you know, the network, if you will.
Yeah.
And the magic clubs are a part of that. The SAM, the IBM. There's Cafe Rustico that we just mentioned. Tannen's, Phantasma. There's a kind of new younger group called Magnets, which meets on Wednesday nights. And the show A Taste of Magic grew out of that. And there's the Friday the Table at the Times Square Diner, which Rich mentioned, which still meets. And
That goes back to the Edison Hotel and the Dixie and Rosoff's from when I was a kid. But that table has continued on all these years. In Chicago, they used to have something like that.
Now, when you say with the Rustica, by the way, I didn't hear what time. Was that a breakfast, or is that still in the afternoon?
It's like noon. Generally around noon, people start gathering,
okay,
give or take. And I would say it goes until about 5, 6. You know, it's very casual. It's informal, but... pretty much you can be assured that somebody will be there starting at noon and be there at least until about 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the
size of the group, I guess it depends upon who shows up. It could be a dozen, it could be 20 or whatever, right?
Yeah, I would say that's true. It really fluctuates.
We had a similar kind of a thing here in Houston for a long number of years, back when the Magic Island used to be here, and that people who were coming in to work at the island, we would meet on Tuesdays for lunch, and they would go anytime from about 11:30 until 2:30 or 3, and there were a lot of people sometimes who were working trade shows, you know, passing through Houston as well, so it could be anywhere from, you know, 8, 10 people or 20 or so. I remember one time that James Randi was in town for something, and he was there for lunch with us, and so you just never knew who was going to be showing up, and I'm sure that your round table is much like that. You know, I just had a conversation with John Sterk, who is working then with the new Chicago Magic Lounge, and they have rejuvenated that Chicago round table, which was something that used to it goes way back also with a lot of notable magicians, as you were saying there, Rich, but it is it kind of fell for a while, and then it kind of rejuvenated, and then a few years ago that no one was attending again, and so now they have a venue again. They actually have a membership, so this way you get a lapel pin and everything. I mean, they've got this part of the membership with the Chicago Magic Lounge, that you become part of the round table, so it's become a more formalized group, I think, than ever before. But the kind of groups that you're talking about are much more informal, I'm sure.
That's the case. I mean, obviously, we have three magic clubs, really, in New York City, the SAM, the IBM, which are formal membership clubs. And then we have the Magnets, which is a club. It's a little less formal in a certain way. Whoever wants to come can just come to the meetings. And there's the SYM, the Society of Young Magicians. But I would say, by and large, like the Cafe Rustico get-together and the table are very informal. It's kind of interesting to me that it has perpetuated all these years with no real authority or no real kind of administrative oversight or anything, which is part of why it's so cool, I think, that it's just gone along out of the enthusiasm and the excitement of people who want to be there and want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, one of the things about Cafe Rustica that I realized is, you know, I grew up reading magic books and later got into videos and all of that, but I didn't have a real community of magic when I grew up in Miami, Florida, and I didn't have a real community of magic. And when I started hanging out there, you know, a lot of the repertoire that I perform now is stuff that I learned from the other guys there. So it's made, I mean, this might be stating the obvious, but it's made a huge difference just to have those people to show me the stuff, you know, and just to see it performed. So
well, that's a very good point.
That's why magic live is so important. Things that are live
right.
are real different than what you watch on TV or even read in a book. It's, if someone wows you and then introduces you to the secret and the technique and the style of performing it, it's a whole other kettle of fish.
Well, that's exactly right, Rich, and I think that is part of the sadness, I guess, of the demise of the brick-and-mortar magic shops, because when you
yes.
go to a shop that you get to not only see something, but you can learn something, and you can spend some time with the guy teaching you how to do it. I mean, you could watch a YouTube video or whatever, but you got to keep watching it over and over. It's still not a hands-on experience where you can ask a question if you don't understand a certain thing. And so, yeah, I think that the live experience can't be beat.
And like Herb said, on a Saturday, you've got the two magic shops nearby, the place where the magicians gather. Mm-hmm. It's a type of a experience that's unique, especially in this day and age. Maybe unique's not the right word, but something that's different and that still has a lot of appeal.
It's interesting because in the time that I've been in New York, I think this has happened throughout its history, but I've kind of seen the fortunes of magic rise and fall in New York City. When I first got here, it was kind of frustrating because I was like, where's all the magic, you know? But it feels like right now, in the last couple of years, has kind of been like an upswing.
A resurgence, uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, right now we still have Derek Delgadio's show running here. And I mean, Rich mentioned a few of the other shows, but we also have Steve Cohen's Chamber Magic, mm-hmm. Dan performing at the Nomad Hotel. The other shows that Rich had mentioned, and then we had The Illusionist, and we had Penn & Teller here on Broadway not too long ago. And, of course, we have the Salute to Magic coming up on April 14th. So between these groups and between these different shows and things, and there's a lot going on in mm-hmm. Magic New York right now.
Well, you had also mentioned about Phantasma, and I know that Roger Dreyer has a little museum also. I think is it like a Houdini museum that he's got there too?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Yeah. Roger's a very enthusiastic Houdini fan and a collector of magic, as mm-hmm. well as being a magic dealer. So that's actually another fascinating thing for out-of-town magicians to come and see. And in the old days, a lot of people would say that. A visit to the big city is not complete without a visit to our magic shop.
You've got, it's a very, you know, it's a really great, I think, he's created a great environment there for a magic shop. He's got all kinds of Houdini posters and memorabilia displayed
yeah.
all over.
And he's really into the old time stuff too. So it's a good place for books and apparatus.
The two magic shops I think have different flavors. The two main ones. There's a couple of other smaller ones. They both have a lot to offer, but they definitely each have their own particular flavor.
Yeah. Can I just say something? Phantasma recently moved.
Weren't they across from the sports arena there?
Yes, they're across from Madison Square Garden for quite some time.
Yes, but it was just recently. They're on 35th Street between 7th and 8th. And my point here is not only that you should know that they moved, but also that he sort of designed the shop with the museum more in mind this time. So when you walk into the shop, it feels like more of a museum than it did in the original store when he sort of was sort of half a shop, half magic shop, half museum. This one, you really have a good feel as if it's a real museum.
Would you say that?
Actually, the first shop was much bigger and only had magic. He didn't have the museum so much in the very first shop.
That's right, the first one, right.
Is this really the only place in New York to see a magic museum?
I think it's the only permanent display. I mean, there's libraries and things like you have the Conjuring Arts Research Center, and then the library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center has a lot of magic material. But in terms of there being a permanent display, I believe that's the only...
No. There's some good collections in New York of books and posters and apparatus in private hands.
Well, you mentioned the Conjuring Arts also. Now, does Bill Kalush open his area to the public or to magicians who are visiting?
By appointment.
Because I would think he'd have a ton of stuff to show.
If you want to conduct research, I mean, it's a research organization, really. And if you want to conduct research, when we were working on Coney Island event, I went to read, I wanted to read a very hard to find book, one that's very scarce, one that was put together by another person participating in this interview. Mr. Cohn's book on Brooklyn magicians is really hard to find. So I went to the Coney, I went to the Conjuring Arts Research Center to read it.
You weren't able to find it through the book dealers? Well, anyway, we'll look at that.
Barnes & Noble did not have it.
Oh, but I think I had forwarded to you about Byron out in California or Richard Hatch.
It was, at that point, it was just a simpler process to go there and read
it. Thank you for digging it up.
I'm just kind of using that as an example, really, that you can do research there.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but they're not a place that's selling magic tricks or videos. So it's really, you know, more of an institution rather than a place that people off the street would go to.
Right. Well,
He's obviously got incredible collections there, and he's really doing a lot to preserve that material and to make it accessible. Ask Alexander is an incredible resource.
It's a wonderful resource. It's great.
Research where you can delve into, like, all these periodicals. I mean, I think they've got all of Mahatma and all of the Sphinx and a lot more online, and it's really very well done. And if you're a member, you have access to it. And so... they deserve a lot of credit, Bill Kalush, and his folks there for putting all that stuff.
Well, now looking kind of into the future just a little bit, have you heard any talk or anybody say anything about opening up any new shows that are coming that have to do with magic or perhaps some sort of a museum, or maybe like along that line, or someone moving or some sort of a venue that might be, let's say, similar to Chicago Magic Lounge or, you know, like the Magic Castle East or something?
I mean, Magic Castle was supposed to open up in New York at one point. David Copperfield was supposed to open up
that place one,
at one point. People are always talking about these things, but it's very costly to stage something like that here in the city.
Sure.
Last year, there was a lot of press about Neil Patrick Harris opening a venue. It definitely didn't happen, and I don't think it's going to happen, but I'm not sure why it didn't happen. But that was... for a while, that was kind of an exciting time.
But there are some more grassroots things going on. Patrick Terry is producing these wonder shows at several different venues. Yeah. So he's given work for magicians and kind of sideshow fringe acts a good opportunity to perform. So there's a number of these other kind of more homegrown things that are happening around town where people are performing at restaurants or putting together their own shows. Even the thing that Herb did last week with the Magic of Coney Island at the library was something that, a really nice magic event, and good attendance. People kind of do these grassroots.
Let me ask then. Also, for people who are going to be coming into New York as we start to kind of wrap up here a little bit and who are traveling to the Big Apple and they want to see a magic tour or at least take a little bit of time away from their family, maybe to go and see something, what should they go see and do? I mean, you said that Derek Delgadio has a show and also the magic shops. And so what do you recommend that people should see and do if they have time?
Well, those are good ones. Also, Monday Night Magic. Every Monday night you can see a magic show. Every Sunday, you can see a magic show at Magic at Coney at the Coney Island Museum on Surf Avenue. So those are regular standbys. And a lot of visiting magicians like to visit Coney Island, just the same way that Houdini and Vernon like to go to Coney Island. It's a very different place than it was in their day, but it's still a fascinating place, and you can see a good magic show while you're there.
And then the round table also, I guess, on Saturdays.
Exactly.
Round table at Cafe Rustica.
I want to mention one thing. This is going to come out in the form of a plug. However, I think it's a very useful resource. I actually have a blog that is called the Magic in New York blog, and it has an extensive listings section.
Yes.
of a lot of the things that we've been talking about, just so that people can find the times and the addresses and all that. The easiest way to get to it is herbsmagic.com, and then there's a link to the blog from there, so it's just herbsmagicaltogether.com. And it kind of outlines as much as I can, you know, find and represent there as to what there is to do relating to magic in New York.
Well, that's a good idea. And be sure to put in a link then on the blog, and also for people to go and take a look at that. And so, again, to wrap up that kind of coming full circle to the salute to magic. Yes, David.
I have a special announcement.
Oh, okay, here we go.
this is a newsworthy announcement. While you guys were talking about things to do in New York, magic-wise, I texted my friend.
Which one was that? You have a friend?
I have a friend, and I texted him, and I asked him if it was okay for me to mention his new show, and he said it is. And the news is that Joshua J. will be doing a one-man show. It's not really a one-man show, but it's a show, a magic show. It's a very unique format for a magic show. I don't want to give that away yet, but he's going to be doing his show, a magic show, in New York City in the months of June and July.
It's called Six Impossibilities or something? Six Mystery?
Six Impossibilities, I think, is what it is called. Yeah. So he said I should mention it.
Well, I'm glad you did, because, yeah, I didn't know if that was out yet, but I had heard about that also, Six Impossibilities. I have heard that is going to be a complete diversion from the kind of show that you've seen Joshua do before, and he had a great show before, and I can only imagine this could be even better. Yeah. So
this is crazy.
Where will that be? Do you know what venue? Where the city?
I think it's downtown. It's in I'm not sure if he wants me to say, but it's in a very unusual venue. Let's say that it is not it's not in a theater.
It's interactive. Let me say, as I understand, it's an interactive experience.
Yes.
We'll just leave it at that. How's that?
Yes. It's very unusual. It is not. You're not going to buy a ticket, step into a theater, sit in a seat, and watch a show. It's going to be completely different to that, and it's a great idea. And he says, you know, some people aren't going to understand the idea, but I think it's a fantastic idea, and I think that's sort of kind of what New York magic is really about, people taking chances and doing new things. New York theater is about people trying new things theatrically, and this is going to be one of those. So it's going to be a great show.
Yeah, if you want to escape the usual, then you could go and check that out.
Yes, that's an excellent suggestion.
Thank you.
It's like Penn and Teller fool us.
All right, and so, as I said, to kind of come full circle and going back to the salute to magic, as we start to close out here, for people, again, who are listening to this and might be in or near the city or planning on going to New York City for a holiday, be sure and get a ticket, because tell me about where they can get the tickets, the show, and the time, and all that again.
It's the Salute to Magic info and tickets are at salutetomagic.com. And all the information is there. It's Saturday night, April 14th at 7:30. The theater is right near Penn Station. So if you're in New Jersey or Long Island, you'll get home nice and early. So, and it's going to be a crazy great show, really great show. Funny, talented magicians, really, really. All these guys you've seen on AGT, The Illusionists, Penn and Teller Fool Us, it's going to be great.
That sounds fantastic. And then the last thing, of course, since my podcast is called The Magic Words, I'm going to ask each of you guys for your word or phrase. And I'll start with you, David, and that'll give a chance then for Rich and Herbert to be thinking about this. But what would be your philosophy of life that may or may not have to do with magic? David?
Oh, my God. Scott, I didn't know that was part of the podcast.
Well, it always is. I always end with that. You know that.
I would say
you always have something different to tell me every time I ask you this.
That's true. Well, you know what I'm thinking about these days? Happiness.
There you go. That's good. Happiness. Yeah. So be happy.
Yes.
You know. Yeah. You know. I would think for you, you want to be silly, but you know, be happy.
Yes. Well, I'm in my free time, I focus on happy.
How about Rich? How about you?
Happy is good. Like happy.
Ooh, happy is
good. Let's stick with that. Happy is good.
Okay. Okay, Herb, you got something original?
Would say that my mantra in magic and in life is the word practice. I keep practicing. Hopefully someday I will get it right.
Good. Well, and it sounds like that everything's kind of been working right in New York City and down through the years. And I appreciate, you know, you guys sharing different snippets of time, not only giving me your time here, but then also to share about some of the history and where we are then up to date, you know, with this. And so I wish you luck with the Salute to Magic and also all the other endeavors. And I look forward to getting a chance to chat with you guys personally in person then sometime rather than over Skype here as we're doing now. But thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Anytime, Scott. When I see you at the next convention, I'll be sure to sit down with you.
Good. Martini will be on you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thanks so much, Scott.
You bet. So that was Herb Scherer and also Rich Cohen and David Kay. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. Well, that was some fun and educational, too, at least for me. I learned a few things. And in fact, after the podcast was concluded, I received a phone call from Richard Cohen, who had corrected me. I think he found out where my mistake was regarding Max Molini and the Friars Club. Apparently, I believe it was John Mulholland who joined the Players Club. And I had the Players and the Friars Club mixed up because he was saying that he probably was John Mulholland because he was the one who was very much, I guess, a gentleman and at ease as far as performing, and was, I believe, one of the only performing magicians who belonged to the Players Club. And so, again, I think I had mixed up the Friars with the Players just because it's a one word and has some R's. I don't know. Anyhow, I believe that at least I will stand corrected and believe that Max Molini did not belong to the Friars Club, but John Mulholland did belong to the Players Club. So, anyhow, with that correction, let me move forward and tell everybody again that I appreciate them, these guys being my guests here for the Magic Word. And also, I want to thank David Kay, who had offered two free tickets to the show this coming Saturday. And if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there you will see an entry form. And if you just complete that with your name and email address, then I will be drawing a random name by noon on Saturday, and you'll be notified. So be sure and watch your email to see if you receive this, because again, this is very time sensitive because the show is just going to be in a couple of days from the date this podcast is released. So if you are interested in attending and you can actually use the tickets or have somebody that you want to give the tickets to who you know would benefit from this, then you can win and you can send me that information then also. I'll draw those names and you'll be contacted, and then David Kay will either call you, send an email, but you'll be contacted to find out where that you can pick up these tickets there at the will call and how you can go about doing that. So again, go to themagicwordpodcast.com and enter the contest there where you put in your name and email address, and then we will have the drawing just within a couple of days. That'll be on Saturday the 14th by noon. Again, that show is going to be that evening at 7:30. So now I'm talking about Eastern Standard Time when I'm saying noon and 7:30 p.m. So anyhow, good luck. And speaking of good luck, I want to also congratulate the winners from the recent contest we had. I want to thank Bloomsbury Publishing House, who are the ones who so graciously have agreed to donate three books to three lucky listeners from Nate Staniforth's newest release, which is Here Is Real Magic. If you didn't get a chance to listen to that podcast, I suggest you go back and listen to it, because that perhaps is going to be one of my top 10 of the all-time best conversations that I've had with some people, because it was pretty deep, had some interesting stuff in there. So even though the contest is now over, you can go back and listen to that, and you can still win by learning a lot of stuff. If you go back and listen to the episode with Nate Staniforth, that was episode number 414. So, the names of the three winners are Bob Hale, Tim Glander, and a friend of the Magic Word, David Thornburg. Congratulations, David, and Tim, and Bob. A copy of Here Is Real Magic will be forwarded to you direct from the publisher, Bloomsbury. All right. Well, I know I said last week that we were going to be having Gregory Wilson as our guest here this week, and I'm going to postpone that now until this next week. So unless something else comes up that is earth-shaking and I think that you guys need to know about that could be time-sensitive, who knows what's going to happen during the next week in our magic world. But if nothing else comes up, my plan is to publish that podcast that I recorded with Gregory Wilson. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be happy. And the best way to get to Carnegie Hall is to practice, practice, practice. This is Scotty out.